Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. We are back with another EB Medicine special, evidence-based medicine. I have grown to really appreciate this series because I learn a lot at the same time as when I'm going through this, and I get to choose what I think would be a good topic to discuss. And this time, what I have found is all about pediatric strokes. And this is something that I have talked a little bit about before. We did a previous podcast with Lawrence Burdan back in podcast number 122. Feel free to check it out. It's in the show notes as well. But we talked about traumatic brain injuries, and we didn't quite go into as much depth as we are with this particular discussion. So I wanted to revisit this since it's been over a year since the last time we talked about it, and to kind of hit some of the nuances and some things that I really learned and thought were new to me that I think would be beneficial to others who are practicing medicine, particularly in the emergency medicine environment. So let's get started. Now, if you're like me, you probably have only heard of pediatric strokes occurring in rare situations. And it is rare overall. It only occurs in 1 to 2 per 100,000 children every year, which is a very small number. But when it does happen, it's serious and it can have a high rate of morbidity and mortality. It carries an overall mortality rate of up to 10% with arterial ischemic strokes and 25% for hemorrhagic strokes. What's even more concerning is that unlike adults, where we have more ischemic versus hemorrhagic strokes, in children it occurs about half and half. Even though we know about neuroplasticity, which is the ability of the brain to change continuously throughout an individual's life, 2/3 of children will have persistent neurological deficits, which means for us is that this isn't one of those, well, the brain will fix itself over time, because it may not necessarily do so. The other tricky part with this is it can take a long time to identify and diagnose these cases, especially compared to adults. And adults, we know to look for this, especially with our older patients who come in with ultra-mental status or some sort of neurological changes. We know to think early about stroke. In children, in one urban center, they found it was 22.7 hours from symptom onset to diagnosis and 12.7 hours from hospital presentation to diagnosis. And on initial assessment, stroke was only suspected in 38% of cases, which means that many times we're not even thinking about this, which is why I find this topic so powerful, is because if we can start thinking about it, we might be able to pick this up more quickly, more readily, and be better at managing these patients. Overall, we're going to talk about two main groups. We're going to break it down. The first is going to be about ischemic, and the second, we're going to talk about hemorrhagic strokes. Ischemic strokes encompass both arterial ischemic strokes, AIS, and cerebral sinus venous thrombosis, or CSVT. AIS is a neurological deficit with an acute infarct in a corresponding arterial territory on brain imaging. The most common causes are as follows: arteriopathies, cardiac etiologies, prothrombic states, and systemic disorders. Arteriopathies account for 50% of all AIS cases in children. This is basically a structural abnormality of the cervical or intracranial artery that is typically diagnosed on vascular imaging or autopsy. The common types are stenosis, aneurysm, dissection, or occlusion not due to an embolus. Children with such abnormalities have a 66% chance of stroke over 5 years. The most common type of focal cerebral arteriopathy is defined as a focal area of stenosis. When considering dissection, remember that pain is not a reliable indicator. Only half of children had a headache at the time of presentation, and neck pain was only present about 1 to 11% of the time, depending on the study. Cardiac etiologies account for 30% of all strokes. They're most commonly due to thromboemboli related to congenital heart disease, acquired valvular disease, cardiomyopathy, or arrhythmias. What we commonly see are atrial septal defects or ventricular septal defects with right-to-left shunts that can cause strokes. Many will occur during surgery or catheterization procedures, which I didn't realize before but makes sense after talking about it. Prothrombic states are generally not a cause for strokes without some other risk factor being present, and the goal should be identifying and potentially modifying said risk factors. The last type, the systemic disorders, some frequent examples include sepsis, intrathecal methotrexate, mitochondrial disorders, and genetic disorders. Treating these strokes is focused on the underlying condition and is often limited. going back to cerebral sinus venous thrombosis, CSVT. It is a state of abnormal clot formation in the deep and dural venous sinuses of the brain. This can lead to impaired arterial inflow and ischemia. It may not follow an arterial pattern and can present with focal neurological deficits and signs of increased intracranial pressure, such as vomiting. The treatment is the underlying cause, such as infection or dehydration, and anticoagulation, even if hemorrhage is present. So let's go ahead and switch over to hemorrhagic stroke. It's defined as any non-traumatic intracerebral hemorrhage, subarachnoid hemorrhage, or intraventricular hemorrhage, excluding those related to prematurity. Arteriovenous malformations, or AV malformations, are the most common cause of hemorrhagic strokes. Bleeding disorders may also cause pediatric hemorrhagic stroke, with thrombocytopenia being the most common hematologic cause of intraparenchymal hemorrhage. The differential diagnosis for this condition is extensive, but the most common stroke mimics are migraines, seizures, Bell's palsy, conversion disorder, and syncope. For the most part, these are benign, but there are potential emergencies that can mimic stroke, such as meningitis, encephalitis, brain tumors, and traumatic brain injuries. Like I said, this is extensive, and there's lots of different things to consider, and there are different distinguishing features. What we have done is included Table 2, which is the differential diagnosis for pediatric stroke from EB Medicine, in the show notes. So please check out the show notes. Go to podcast number 178 and look for EB Medicine pediatric stroke, and you'll be able to find it there. One of the most common ones we think about is differentiating strokes from migraines in children, which can also be a challenge also in adults. Migraines are more frequently associated with visual symptoms and vomiting. There can be neurological deficits in complex migraines, but this is usually focal numbness. Neurological symptoms of migraine commonly resolve within 30 minutes. In arterial ischemic strokes, though, this has a sudden onset focal weakness. Less commonly will you see numbness, with speech or language changes, ataxia, and or seizures. Keep in mind that infants are more likely to have non-focal signs, such as altermental status or seizures. How can we pick this up? Because like I said, this can be so challenging. There's a broad differential. There's a lot of mimics out there. A solid history is a good place to get started, as it can help identify and distinguish the strokes from the mimics. The history should focus on the time of onset, stroke risk factors, and elements that can help narrow the differential, such as fever, trauma, and family history. Risk factors for arterial ischemic strokes include sickle cell disease, congenital heart disease, prothrombotic conditions, and in some cases, recent head, neck, or respiratory infections in the preceding 3 days. Risk factors for hemorrhagic stroke include antithrombotic medication use, bleeding disorders, thrombocytopenia, cancer, and a history of intracranial hemorrhage. Sickle cell disease can also increase the risk of hemorrhagic stroke, just like it can for arterial ischemic strokes. In regards to the physical exam, the first step should be your ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation, as always. We also want to do a neurological exam as complete as possible, but also understanding in the critically ill patients, we may not have much time before we need to do other interventions such as intubation. While things are being set up, we should be able to do some basic evaluations, such as evaluating all four extremities and the level of responsiveness. The more we can get done before we sedate and intubate that patient, the more information we can have later. As part of the neurological assessment, the NIH stroke scale, the National Institute of Health Stroke Scale, or NIHSS, has been adapted for children aged 2 to 17 years, and it's called the PEDS NIHSS, which accounts for the development level of the child. Another step that should be considered is assessing for toxidromes, as this is a frequent mimic. We know about toxidromes, we have covered it in the past in previous podcasts, but basically what we're looking for is, can there be some toxicologic cause for the symptoms? Again, another mimic. Speaking of ways to identify mimics, testing should be focused on stroke mimics, with a very important one early on being the blood glucose. Hypoglycemia, just like in adults, can be a common cause of a pediatric stroke mimic. Other lab studies should include CBC, CMP, PT-PTT with INR, toxicology, and a pregnancy test if applicable. An EKG should also be considered. Initial imaging is usually going to be MRI if it's accessible, but if you're practicing in rural or remote environments such as I am, CT is going to be your go-to. This is primarily for ruling out hemorrhage. However, vascular imaging should be obtained when ischemic or hemorrhagic stroke is identified or it's highly suspected based on the presentation, just like we would do for adults. As far as what we can do, assuming that we have a history and physical as well as laboratory testing that all is pointing towards stroke, what should the treatment be? Well, the initial treatment is, as always, your ABCs and addressing them first. Correcting hypoxemia, hypoglycemia, dehydration, anemia, and fever should all be performed. Anticonvulsant medications are not done empirically in the absence of seizures. In arterial ischemic strokes, antiplatelet medications such as aspirin and anticoagulants such as heparin or low molecular weight heparin are used. In cerebral sinus venous thrombosis, unfractionated heparin or low molecular weight heparin are recommended in addition to treating the underlying cause. Thrombolytics are not the standard of care at this point, but can be considered in specific situations in coordination with pediatric neurology. As we have talked about in the adult literature, even the adult literature is very mixed on thrombolytics. However, we do know from adult literature that mechanical thrombectomy is a potential option. In children, it has been used in arterial ischemic strokes with children as young as 2 years of age. However, I believe this needs some specialized equipment and there's very limited data on it. So it is something to at least talk about with pediatric neurology, but just understand that thrombolytics and mechanical thrombectomy are not yet part of the standard of care. This was talking about overall the broad cases and the general overview of what to do with pediatric strokes. I do want to mention specifically sickle cell disease as there is more literature to back it up and the incidence rate is much higher. There are 285 cases of strokes per 100,000 children with sickle cell disease annually. When treating children with sickle cell disease, the treatment has some variation. However, aspirin is given primarily to decrease the amount of hemoglobin S and transfusion of red blood cells to a total hemoglobin of 10 to 11 grams per deciliter is another target. Another way you can reduce hemoglobin S to less than 30% can be through exchange transfusion. Just like we do with hemorrhagic strokes overall, we manage hemorrhagic strokes by preventing further bleeding. Also, hypotension should be addressed while avoiding hypertension. So we're wanting a goal blood pressure. This will vary by age, just like it does when we're talking about overall blood pressures in children. But keep in mind that we want to try and keep them normotensive as much as possible. Hypoxemia and hypoglycemia should be treated. The intracranial pressure should be kept from rising, elevating the head of the bed to 30 degrees, and keeping the patient calm and or sedated has been used effectively in the past. Surgical craniotomy is an option when decompression is needed, but it is rare. It is worth noting that management remains somewhat controversial and has been changing over time slowly given the limited pediatric evidence, but some of this is based on the adult literature. Outside of sickle cell disease, there has been no randomized controlled trials in management of pediatric strokes. However, what we can tell is that early identification is key for treating these patients appropriately. If you enjoy this content, you should check out EB Medicine. Evidence-based medicine has all sorts of discussions like this. They have pharmacology, trauma, stroke discussions. They focus a lot on pediatrics and adult medicine, which they break up into two separate sections on their website, and they do a really good job going through these every month. I enjoy reading these, and right now you can get $50 or more off of your subscription with EB Medicine. I have a special link in the show notes. Just go to it, click at the bottom of the page where it says click on the link to go to their website, and you can learn more from there. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.